The Science Show. This week comes from the Galapagos Islands, an hour's flight from the coast of continental Ecuador. It's right on the equator, and I'm here on a personal trip, so no budgets were harmed in the making of this program. And if you saw David Attenborough's magnificent Galapagos series, then this is a follow-up, one that you might do, being escorted by naturalists from Ecuador, as access to these famous islands is strictly controlled. You don't just wander about on your own. I'm on a big ship, but we get to each contrasting island by means of a zodiac, a rubber boat led by an expert guide. So let's land and see what's there. Now, could you tell me your name?
Juan Lamilla, Juan Carlos.
And you're from?
I'm from Ecuador, from Guayaquil.
Guayaquil, which is just
Guayaquil
on the...
Guayaquil is the main port in Ecuador.
And we're on the island here in the Galapagos of Santiago.
Yes.
And did Darwin actually come here to where we're standing?
Walking around here into all of this area. He explored it around 5-7 days. But it's been there in Galapagos around over a month.
And so that was about 1835.
Just a moment, please. Let me show you, please, something very important around here. We have a 2 seasons in the island between January and to April, May. That is the hot moment, the rainy season in the island, right? Why? Because arrived the Panama current from the north. Panama currents is two warm currents in that moment, raining for 3 or 4 months. And, well, could be raining for 2 or 3 hours during the day. But that is the best time for Darwin finches, for mockingbird, because they find a lot of humidity, a lot of insects, right? And indeed, they have a lot of berries in Galapagos Island, right? In that moment, February, March, all of these areas will be very, very greenish and humidity. But the second one season, from May to December, that is the cool season in Galapagos Island, because arrived the Humboldt current from the south. Humboldt current is very chilly water. That is the best moment for the marine life, right? Especially what sea lions mating all year round. We have the whales, we have a humpback whales, minke whales, then we have the bottlenose dolphin approach. So, normally all year round, even orcas or killer whales. But July, August, September is the cool season in the island. This is the best time for the swimming and snorkeling. It's too cold, right? But it's the best moment for the marine life, especially for blue-footed boobies and Nazca boobies. And that is the moment from May to December to arrive the wave albatrosses and nesting for 7-8 months in Espanol Island, right? The wave albatrosses, that's it. Any question, please?
This is the biggest island, one of the biggest islands?
No, one, the third one. First one, Isabela, Santa Cruz.
And this, but this is a big one.
One of the big ones.
And when we went yesterday past, is it Daphne Island?
Daphne, maybe on my mind.
There are two scientists who...
Rosemary and Peter Grant.
And what do they do there?
They're working about to the Darwin finches.
They study the finches?
Yeah, the and evolution. They have the reproductions of the Darwin finches.
And is it true they've been going there for about 20 years?
Yeah, more or less. A lot of time.
And they actually stay on that tiny island?
Well, they have for each 2 years to spend several months in that area.
Work on those finches. And those two islands where the scientists live are so tiny, and they spend months there. Now, as we walk, we see a sea lion mother suckling her calf and then leaving.
They have in this moment, mommy, we have a low tide in this moment. She has the opportunity for fishing better, diving more. For that reason, living alone for 3-4 hours, depending on the age of the baby. That baby looks like 3 or 4 months old. She's going to live in alone for 4 or 5 hours, more or less. Because she needs to fish, and any moment came back, and they found the babies in the same area. I'm barking, the mommy barking for calling, and the same time compliment with the smell. For that reason, one of the rules, not touch the animal.
But she's coming towards us.
Oh, yeah.
She wants to touch me.
Yeah, it's looking. Like I thought her behavior.
Hello there, you're about 2 meters away.
She's waiting for mommy, right?
So mummy's fishing.
Yeah, she's mummy's fishing in this moment.
May I just ask you, what's over there?
The marine iguanas. We have marine iguanas down there. Look at that one.
Let me have a look. It's about, what, 0.5 meter long? It's got greenish frills down its back.
It looks fake.
It looks fake?
Yeah. This looks like a rock. It's crazy.
It's got black hands holding onto the rock. And There's something crawling next to it. What is that?
Hermit crab.
That's a hermit crab. And the marine iguana, having been in the water, is now warming up again because they're cold-blooded. Isn't that right? They go out to sea and they nibble seaweed underwater because there's not enough on land. And this one's alone. And what about all those very large, rosy-coloured pink crabs?
They're salilite food crabs, endemic species to the island. We're going to find for everywhere around the whole Galapagos Island. Look at that, baby sea lions.
Now I'm just walking past a marine iguana, getting so used to them. I mean, they're all over the place. I shouldn't be this close. I'm about, 1 meter away, and it's hardly giving me a glance. I haven't seen them snort. They snort to get rid of the salt that they imbibe when they're down under the water eating seaweed. And over here we have a giant bird. Let me see if I can find Juan Carlos to find out what it is. It's something like more than a meter high. Juan Carlos, we're about, 20 meters from this huge bird that's, at least a meter high. And it's grey, it's got black, brown feathers, and it's looking at us in a very kind of wise and very relaxed way. What is it?
This is a great blue heron. It's a permanent resident in the island, we call it. It's a native.
So this one's resident, it doesn't...
Resident, we call it permanent resident in the island. We call it endemic because they have mating only here. They changed something from the ancestor because no change, arrived 1,000 years.
And you've got those giant pelicans, great pelicans flying past.
The brown pelicans.
Brown, is it?
Brown pelicans in the island.
Now, having been here all these years, have you got used to the Galapagos yet? Do you just take it for granted? Do you just think, oh, yeah, here they are again?
I enjoy the life. I live in here for 20 years. I've been, like, naturalist 12 years. I like to be here diving, walking, swimming. I enjoy the nature. Look at that one.
And when you go diving, have you been surrounded by sharks?
Right, I'm sure. Yeah. That's amazing.
How many sharks have you been surrounded by at one time?
Wow, I saw people diving with even with pictures, 100 of them around it. Yeah, that is scary.
100 what sort of sharks?
I don't know, I didn't ever...
Hammerhead, yeah?
A hammerhead, the most common, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they don't attack you?
Not yet.
You smell wrong.
Oh, yes. Another eruptions, right? Isabella, Darwin, and Alcedo Volcano, the three volcanoes in Galapagos Island, right? That is a Fernandina. That is was the last one volcanic activity. Even this island, 130 years ago, more or less, they have one big volcanic activity. This afternoon, we're going to walk in the new lava float. They're going to be exciting.
In the lava float?
In the lava float, right.
Wouldn't that be a bit too hot?
Normally, yes. I hope no.
Oh, that's challenging. Well, this has been the first few minutes of me on a Galapagos island, and the first impressions are that you cannot believe how much wildlife there is just everywhere. If you walk too fast, you find you might be stepping over a marine iguana just there, disguised on the black rock. And round the corner is yet another suckling mother sea lion with pup, and so many of these pink crabs everywhere, birds hovering in the sky. I've got about 40 or 50 marine iguanas, some chasing each other or seeming to chase each other in a quite steady pace, and all over the black lava, which is characteristic of these islands. And as you heard, volcanoes as far as the eye can see. And over my head comes one of those brown pelicans zooming past towards the horizon.
Monica Plaza. I'm a Galapagos National Park naturalist for 20 years. And at the moment, I'm a cruise director in this ship.
And as we look over there, we can see a wonderful red beach with very high, I'd say mountains, yes, with cliffs eroded, and there are white spots on the cliff. What are they?
Guano. The guano is the, you know, seabird feces, and you can tell it's a very popular rock with the seabirds. Probably guano from pelicans or blue-footed boobies.
And the scientists working there virtually all the time on different islands?
Yes, most of the work is done in the fields, yes. There will be places where you can go as a volunteer, you know, if you join one of those scientific groups going there.
Going back, say, 50, 60 years, is it the case that people from Ecuador were actually farming here on the islands?
They still are. Yes, we have families, perhaps maybe four or five generations already from Ecuadorians that have been here, maybe more. Because actually the islands were declared Ecuadorians in 1832, and you have people in San Cristobal from that long ago. Yes.
Farming of what?
We have cattle ranching mainly, yes. But we do have also a group of a fishing community as well, which is allowed here. Mm-hmm. Maybe 1,000 families live on that. Artisanal fishing, not industrial fishing.
Mm-hmm. Artisanal fish. What's the difference?
The difference is that we don't have these huge boats that are factories where you put everything. You know, we have seasons. We do it in a sustainable way. You know, we have seasons for lobster, seasons for sea cucumbers, and they have measurements, and they are very regulated by the Park Service.
Yes, I've been most impressed by the regulations and the thoroughness with which people from Ecuador keep out visitors carrying all sorts of seeds and rubbish that otherwise would be a problem. But nonetheless, many years ago, people brought in rats, all sorts of nasty pests. Are they still there?
The rats, yes, I'm afraid they are. We have been managed to clean some of the islands. Like, we have eliminated the pigs from Santiago, over 100,000 goats between the northern part of Isabela and Santiago Islands. But the rats, I would say, it's impossible. We have managed to clean some little islets from rats, but the black rats were introduced when men came here in 1535 when the Spanish discovered the islands. They've made an experiment with rats, not here, but it's been done outside, where you can a rat can stay afloat for 2 miles before they drown. So if the very old ships, in the 15, the pirates, the buccaneers, the whalers, of course they were on board and they just swam ashore.
And you said 100,000 goats.
Yes, we have eliminated over 100,000 goats from the northern part of Isabela and Santiago. It's a goat and pig free island now, Santiago. Unfortunately, we still have the rats, and we still have to breed tortoises. We still collect the eggs from there, because otherwise the hatchlings would never survive due to the rats.
There are many islands with different kinds of tortoise, and very famously they found on one island poor old Lonesome George, who is
passed away now.
He's passed away, yes, yeah. Attenborough had him on the television, and I think 2 weeks after he was filmed, he passed away. He'd been alone for how many years?
They estimated the age was probably 100 years, but alone, they found him like in the 30s.
50 years on his own, poor fellow. No, what is that? I'm looking out to my left, out to sea, about, 300 metres. It looks like a feeding frenzy. What is it?
It is a feeding frenzy of Galapagos shearwaters, probably 300 of them. And I see a couple Nazca boobies. They're all after probably school of sardines or mullets right on the surface. It's a typical Galapagos sight.
I heard a story that some of the pelicans have a bird land on their back and wait till they regurgitate the fish from the pouch, and this little bird steals the fish. Is that right?
Yes, that's the brown noddy tern. It's one of our endemic subspecies, brown noddy tern, and it's actually waiting for the living fish to escape from the pouch while the pelican is emptying the water of the pouch, and then they can swallow the tiny mullets or sardines. And so some of them manage to escape from the beak. That's what the brown noddy is waiting for live fish to come out from the beak pouch.
And so there is a pelican, a brown pelican, actually out sitting on the ocean. Does it mind having a bird sitting on its back?
It doesn't seem at all that he minds. He's just minding his business, emptying his pouch and swallowing. So whatever escapes, he can share. Yes.
Okay, thank you, and let's go to shore.
Okay, let's go.
And you're listening to The Science Show on Radio National, coming from the Galapagos Islands, where we were just on Rabida Island, which is rust red and quite large. All these islands differ in size depending on when the volcano first erupted, and of course the tallest ones, the biggest ones, are the most recent. The other ones have been worn down as the plate goes over the hot spot and new islands are formed, but the older ones get flatter and sometimes sink. It was remarkable landing on Rabida Island to see a sea lion who'd just given birth just minutes before we landed. There was the mother moving the young baby around and the afterbirth lying next to her, and as we watched, a mockingbird came to eat some of the afterbirth, and the mother fussed trying to get the baby away from the lapping water higher up the shore. And it was quite incredible how the other sea lions came close and she shoo them away. Apparently the mother looks after the baby for 2 days with the secretions of very rich milk, and the baby grows, and then she goes off to sea to find some fish and feed it more. They look after their babies very well on Rabida Island. Previously in Puerto Egas on the island of Santiago, which is also quite large, on shore a rather remarkable thing happened with one of the visitors who thought he discovered an albino marine iguana. There it was on a piece of rock looking all white and its arms sticking out and the head rather stark. And so he took lots of photographs and boasted on the way back to one of the naturalists, who said, well, frankly, sorry to disappoint you, but that wasn't an albino marine iguana. That was a skeleton you've just photographed. Ah, well, on Isabella, the very large island, we had to cross the equator and come back south again, looping round. There were mangroves, huge mangroves, and Elizabeth Bay, which is essentially turtle central. So many turtles there and penguins. But three sets of turtles we saw were actually mating. There you had the female trying to keep the male up above her, carrying him. The mating took some hours, and meanwhile there's another male standing by to take over, because the whole process takes an awful long time and apparently requires more than one male. Hours, yes, hours. And one of the Canadian women, one of the tourists who watched, said if it took that long with us, the population would crash to zero. Oh, well. Next, we go to a volcano, Darwin Volcano, to see what we can find.
So welcome to Sullivan Bay. In Sullivan Bay, and then on the other side we have Bartolomé. So this is a very beautiful island here. And then in this morning, in this visit here, where we got to see the lava formation. So we got to hear lava, and then lava. Yeah, because you see in this area, when we have this condition, when there's no vegetation here, also is no, you know, the animal here. Few lava lizards, sometimes we have a sun snake, we have a few finches as well, and then very few species also here. The one is the cactus. You know, we have a different kind of cactus. The one is the prickly pear cactus, and then also we have the lava cactus. The lava cactus is very, very small species, so that one is endemic to Galapagos, and also is endemic to the areas, you know, very new lavas. And we call the pioneer species, and then one is this is the tequila. Not tequila, no, not tequila. So this is endemic, pioneer. But on this lava, you know, when the age on this lava is just around 130 years old, so this is very new, so that's the reason, you know, we had a really hard condition. And then it's not really good place, you know, for the species, you know, survive here. But some species start making here. Okay.
So now I'm walking over, what, 100-year-old lava, and it's just stretching forever. These great piles of it, like giant black cowpats. Huge things with, as David was saying, not one blade of grass, not one piece of wildlife, apart from, there's a lava lizard running in front of me. I wonder what he eats. It's probably bits of insect, if you can find any. And he's blending in quite wonderfully with the landscape. And it looks not just like a landscape, but a kind of black moonscape. Obviously, this is one of the newer islands, if it's got active volcanoes. Obviously, it's come out of the ocean quite recently. And surrounded by hills, all of them conical, which indicates that they must have been volcanic themselves. And off we trudge.
It's information like in Hawaii. You know, this is a volcanic and oceanic island. So we have the similar condition. Now, this is a volcanic oceanic island. So yes, you know, when the volcano starts to erupt here, so it starts to appear here, the islands. And then the name for the lava, you know, the one lava we call the pahoehoe. Pahoehoe means flat lava or slippery lava, and also sometimes ropey lava. So that means, you know, pahoehoe. And then we have another kind of lava we call the haha lava or eye lava. So that's a very sharp lava. We adopt this name, probably, you know, for the lava, because you walk barefoot on the lava, so they hurt your feet. So you say, I. So that's the name, you know, for this lava. And all this lava is basalt. And then, yes, in this basalt, also, you know, we have many different minerals. So, but the ones to the mineral here, you see, is the iron. So when we have the combination of the iron with the gas, with the water, so change the colors. So that's the reason you see on this lava. In some part, we have black, but in another part, we have color brown, and even in red, because, you know, it's more concentration of the iron, and then, yes, you know, produce a chemical process, and then change the color on this lava. So they move very, very fast. So that means it's also very, very hot. It's over 1,200 degrees Celsius. So that's the two different kinds of lava we have here. So this pahoehoe is very, very common in the whole this area. You observe here in the rocks. But then also, you see, under this lava, we have another material here. We have ash. We have a pyroclastic rest. So, and then also probably was water here. So they make a big bubbles. So this is very, very interesting. Okay, let's continue.
David Inger, and it's quite extraordinary to see how some tiny spindles of plants are trying to establish themselves, some of them with tiny flowers, and apparently the finches come along and sample the flowers and, of course, take some seed with them and spread that way. But over there, about 100 metres from where I'm standing, is a bunch of cactus. It's really the most wonderfully brave thing. Somehow they're growing on what is virtual rock. They've established some sort of foothold, if you like, and pioneer species beginning to establish some kind of green life on this utterly black, hugely extensive lava landscape. That's how gradually life begins to form, succeeded by more and more different plants and eventually animals. And one last thought as we leave this extraordinary landscape, which seems so barren apart from the spindles of tiny plants and those brave cactuses clutched together, the only signs of life on what is really the most amazing reminder of the origin of the Galapagos Islands. And David stoops down and picks up a sliver of blue stuff. Now, what's a tiny bit of blue doing here? And he warns us, well, that actually is rat poison. Even here, they're still trying to combat those appalling pests, which first landed, of course, hundreds of years ago when the Spaniards came out with their ships and those hardy rats flew to shore. They're still trying to get rid of them, along with, as you heard, the hundreds of thousands of goats that were brought here and needed to be eliminated. Ah well, on we go. And now to a situation of contrasts, the town on Isabella, where Darwin landed. And the place is absolutely packed with sea lions. In fact, the water slides and the play area built for children is actually crammed full of sea lions. And the tube down which the
children are supposed to float. It's actually got this great big half-ton sea lion in it. Good evening. It's not very happy. Wants me to clear off. Great big mouth full of teeth.
This is for children.
It's for children, isn't it?
Yes.
He seems very happy taking out. I wonder whether the kids get him out of the way. Mind you, they're probably sheltering from the rain. Ah. Now I'm by the shore at San Cristobal, and on the shoreline we've got something like 150 sea lions just lounging around, a couple of them with offspring, and mockingbirds wandering around having a bit of a feed. It's interesting that not only in the water park at San Cristobal, where the kids are supposed to be playing, I suppose, do you have sea lions taking over, but most of the park benches, instead of tourists or locals sitting on the bench, you've actually got sea lions. And here's one coming towards me now, looking very friendly. You going to say something? Evening. It's quite a young fellow. Comparatively slim. No, he's going off again. I'm obviously not terribly exciting. And finally, here we've got a mother with offspring almost the same size, desperately trying to get hold of a teat to suckle on. Yes, he's found it. And what it tastes like with all that sand getting in the way, can't imagine. Meanwhile, there's a brawl over there. How do you run a town when the population of sea lions is far greater than the population of people? Now we go on a little town bus up to the monument where Charles Darwin is commemorated. Well, now we've walked away in San Cristobal, out of the way of those ferocious sea lions. No, they're quite pleasant really, except that they don't like their water slides and other territories infringed high above the coastline, and we can look down and see lots of rocks, and there's a bit of a quay there with three sea lions on it, and here in front of me is Charles Darwin with suitably a finch singing on top of his head. We've come through great big stands of giant cactus, many of them with fairly soft spikes. The spikes don't have to be quite as tough when you don't have tortoises and land lizards, land iguanas, chomping them, and so they can grow rather more sturdily. But they still retain their spikes, and the spikes are soft. They need to be retained because they pick up water, and that's how the water balance of the plant is maintained, especially now in what is the beginning of the rainy season. The statue of Darwin is very tall, about 2.5 times the size of a real person. He's got great big hands, and he's looking out into the distance. He doesn't look like Darwin, actually, quite a young man, great big coat. He's holding a book called Galapagos in his hand.
We have the statue of Charles Darwin on this part here. On this area of San Cristobal, Darwin did one of his stops on this part, right? He was able to collect many different species. Actually, on San Cristobal, he collected one of the four type of mockingbirds that we have on the Galapagos, right? You have seen some of them on Isabela, for example. Those are known as the Galapagos mockingbirds. The one that he collected from here was known, is known actually as the Chatham mockingbird. Most of the islands have an English and an Spanish name. San Cristobal is the Spanish one. Chatham is the one for English on this part here, due to the British colonies that we had at the beginning on this part right here. Now, for the whole trip that Darwin did on this area, we did a nice monument. He visited San Cristobal once again, which is known to be our capital on this part here. The statue, you see his hand is pointing to the back.
This is the area where he actually landed. We have him actually going up to the highlands. He collected a couple of the birds. He got to see the giant land turtles. It's also on this part right here. Remember, the giant land turtles are very famous all over around the Galapagos. They do show a neat adaptation for their shells. Even though sometimes they might look very similar to us, their shells are actually different depending on the areas where they live. Some of them will be adapted for lower vegetation. Some of them will be adapted for higher vegetation. This is something that Charles Darwin did not notice when he came to this part right here. He was more interested in a couple of different things. In a couple of his diaries, he wrote that he was very amazed by the landscape, right? You can see amazing views all over on this part right here, right? So Charles Darwin was mainly paying attention to a lot of the geology of the islands most of the time on this part, and he was collecting a lot more of the species at the same time on this part here, right? So that was his trip right here for Darwin on San Cristobal. You can see him with all the animals on this part right here. San Cristobal has always been well known for sea lions. You saw lots of them at the right front, many sea lions all over around the place. Actually, the walk board was built to protect the town from the sea lions because they were walking all over around the town, right? Sea lions are very nice, but if they leave their droppings on your door, oh, that's not nice at all, right? Okay? Okay, my name is Marvi Cordova.
Marvi Cordova, and you're a naturalist?
Yes, I'm a naturalist right here in Galapagos.
Tell me, how well do the Ecuadorian people regard Charles Darwin? You know, he's famous here, there's a statue here, but throughout Ecuador, do they think he's a hero?
I don't really think so. No. Most people usually in Ecuador don't really know that much about what is nature on the islands, things like that. Everybody thinks Galapagos is a part because we have special laws, especially from the UNESCO program that protects the islands, so not everybody's allowed to live here. Not really that much of people in Ecuador will know that much about the islands, and I'm pretty sure they don't know that much about Charles Darwin. Most of them might hear a little bit, a small piece of him during maybe, I don't know, science, right, on one of the classes, and a little bit more about evolution, but that will be it. Not that much. On Galapagos, he's pretty big. He basically put us on the map, right? So he's very famous on this part right here.
Yes, indeed. And you were saying before that you don't have land iguanas or tortoises here at San Cristobal. What happened to them?
Not on this part. On the area where we're walking, we don't have them, right? What happens on this part here is when we had the first colony in the 1820s, gentleman who was in charge of this whole colony right here, Manuel J. Cobos, he killed most of them, right? He built a big industry for the meat and the oil, right? So he was making a lot of money with that. Plus, he was harvesting sugarcane also on this part here. So he wiped the whole part of this island from land turtles and land iguanas.
Yeah, they were pretty convenient, these giant tortoises. You could stick them on a ship and store the meat and open them whenever you felt like it, you know, a few weeks later out to sea.
That is true. It's been said, actually, but a lot of the whalers who sailed through the Galapagos, they had wrote on their blogs about the lifespan of the land turtles without their food and water, right? That's why they took so many of them. It's estimated that they can live over a year. There is a few stories for some of them that they claim that the land turtles can live over 2 years, actually, without the food and water.
2 years without food and water? That's incredible.
Yes. Well, it has to do also with their system, right? They have this, it might be like a defense for them, getting them ready for where seasons are very bad for them, right? This reptile has very drastic adaptations. They can store fat on their bodies, which then later can turn them into liquids to survive. You have seen the islands of this part here, very barren lava, no water whatsoever. So they must have very drastic adaptations, right?
Thank you, Marvi.
My pleasure, sir.
And my naturalist friend tells me that it was in fact guano, those great big white patches you see on rocks all around here. It's obviously bird poo, lashings of it. That is the secret that turned Ecuador, the president, way back in the 1820s, towards actually having the Galapagos as part of this state. Because otherwise they thought, well, it's a bunch of old islands and few wild creatures on them, but of no great account. But guano could be something extremely valuable. Unfortunately, unlike in other parts of the world, the guano turned out to be fairly thin and didn't produce the kind of industry that necessarily might have been in the president's mind. But the Galapagos became, therefore, part of Ecuador, a feces origin, if you like. Now I'm on the tiny island of North Seymour, and what a contrast. The sun is beating down. The trees are quite low and grey and leafless. Sea lions everywhere. In fact, we couldn't get off the boat because sea lions were getting in the way. Some young ones, some older ones, and some of them just lying there looking at me, indolent. And all around here you have gigantic birds, frigate birds, the great frigate bird and the marvellous frigate bird, one with a red patch under its chin if it's a male, which then inflates into a great big balloon. You may have seen on television, you may have seen in David Attenborough's series. And, oh gosh, a finch just landed in front of me. One of those ground finches that fascinated Darwin so much. But all around you've got these nests, either at waist level or at eye level. And in each nest you've got the juveniles of these frigate birds. Now, I must tell you, the adult ones have got a wingspan of something like 7 feet, or nearly 2 meters. They're gigantic birds. And apparently the youngsters sit there in the nest for about 10 months being fed. And they're, some of them, the young ones, very, very fluffy indeed with their white feathers. And they turn their white feathers to the sun so that they can actually cool. And they pant a bit to keep their temperatures down. It is very, very hot. And one wonders how they can survive without either shade or terribly much water. Apparently the water comes from the cactuses which they peck at. And there in front of me is not just one of those marine iguanas, but a land iguana, which is a different colour. It's the size of a very large cat, a sort of ginger of that kind of colour as well, with a great big smile. Apparently they chomp cactuses for a living, and they're quite indolent. This one's moving quite slowly across my path. And further in the distance, you have, along the coastline, lots of blue-footed boobies whose nests are on the ground. And being completely free of predators, they can take that kind of risk, and they again look after their youngsters for quite some time until, having shed a bit of weight and a few of their juvenile feathers, they can then take off and start fishing themselves. It really is the most huge rookery, hundreds upon hundreds of these giant birds in nests up, if they're frigate birds, at about waist level, or on the ground if they're boobies. Hundreds of these birds calling the males of the frigates, doing a bit of a dance, waving their wings for the females to take interest, and all completely protected from any kind of prey, which is why their numbers are so gigantic, and they have been able to evolve so incredibly quickly to adapt to these particular, different, special conditions here out in the Galapagos. And now meet Pepe. Pepe looks very well fed. He's lying here in the rain, great big fat neck, chomping away at leaves. His front legs are quite stout. Huge shell, as you can imagine. I'd imagine he weighs a third of a ton, but who can tell? I'm not going to lift him. Pepe, to introduce you properly, is a giant tortoise, and he was given his name by the first trustees of the Agama family, who took care of him up to 18 years of age, when by agreement with Monsignor Ugolino Sarasulo, the third prefect of the current apostolic vicarate of the Galapagos, materialised the move to his facilities in 1967, becoming the first missionary in the islands. This tortoise, whose age and accurate origin is unknown, is presumed to be from San Cristobal Island and estimated that he's about 63 years old. I think he looks more like 70, and he's currently part of the breeding program managed by the Galapagos National Park in order to improve the status of the population of island tortoises. He's looking off to my right now and serenely surveying his solitary empire, and obviously in absolutely flourishing good health. Now let's go and see some of the offspring he may have given rise to. Well, that was Lonesome Pepe. Then you're listening to The Science Show on RN, and I'm walking up a red track through a kind of forest of 100-year-old, very large cactus plants. They're just about the same age as the tortoises I'm about to see, which can live to about 100, 150 years. And I'm with a naturalist called William, who's about to introduce us to some of these creatures which are being bred to make up for the fact that many of them became extinct on certain islands. And now you can repopulate parts of the Galapagos with these marvellous huge creatures.
Let me tell you first, this building here was the original tortoise breeding center. It's been actually afforded by the San Diego Zoo. They started back in the 1960s. And this is a conservation program that conserves the incubation, you know, the artificial incubation of the tortoise eggs here. They have some incubators because in the wild, they are exposed to the predators. And there's very low survival rate in the wild of this species. So that's why they have started this conservation program, bringing the first eggs of some tortoises from the islands in the mid-1960s. They had a couple of incubators in there. And afterwards, what I do is to raise the little ones until they grow big enough to be repatriated. They send them back to their original islands. Okay, they make sure tortoises are sent back to the islands where they belong to by marking them here, okay? So this is in short what they're doing here to try to redress the balance, because the tortoises have been actually wiped out of the islands by the whalers, other sailors in the past centuries, and nowadays we're trying to repopulate the islands with the baby tortoises. So please, let's go there and take a look of the baby tortoises first. Cover that they have the baby tortoises in each one of these pens.
They're tiny, aren't they?
They are. They are like miniature, you know, giant tortoises. They have several of these pens all over the place. If you take a look over there, they have actually almost 1,000 baby tortoises right now here in the Darwin Station. And as I said before, they started back in the mid-1960s, bringing the first tortoise eggs from Pinzon Island. And obviously, they had to improve a lot this activity. It was, after all, the first time somebody was doing this kind of conservation program. So at first, they had to experiment several times, right? They didn't have a very high successful hatching rate. But nowadays, after about 50 years, they have improved a lot. Is over 88% the hatching successful rate, okay? Well, the incubators are in a little building that you're gonna see later, and after they hatch out, they bring their little baby tortoises in some dark boxes to simulate what happens in the wild. And then after a couple of weeks, they bring them here. So the ones you see here are actually the youngest, you know, baby tortoises. Some of them are youngest than others. Look at the sign, for instance. These are from Santiago Island. They were born in last year, 2013. So some of them are not even 1 year old. The little ones will be in these little pens for the first 2 years, because when they are newly hatched, the baby tortoises are very small and vulnerable. They are soft-shelled. So they could be an easy prey for any kind of predator, like a rat, for instance, or a cat, or whatever else that's wandering on the islands. That's why they protect them here with this mesh wire, especially at night, all right, to prevent these predators. But they will open up, of course, later on this cover, okay? But notice, inside the pens, I repeat, there's the little ones. For the first 2 years, they live inside the pens. And after 2 years, they release them in the open corral down there, where you can see some other ones which are a little bigger. Notice also that they carry a number on their carapazor shell.
Yes, they're in fact this about twice the size of your spread hand. So pretty small. There's no indication, as you just look at them, that they're going to be these giant creatures weighing a third of a ton or more.
As you can see down there, each one of these corrals or pens have a pond, right, which they fill with water, obviously to provide the tortoises some water to drink or to cool off. The tortoises carry numbers of different colors on the shell because they belong to several islands. So in this way, they identify the baby tortoises. Meanwhile, they're here, they're going to carry this number on the shell. It's either blue or yellow or white according to the island they belong to. Say, Pinzon Island, Santa Cruz, Española, Santiago Island, okay? In this station, they have tortoises of all these islands, four islands. And well, after two or three more years that they adapt them gradually to the natural environment here, they're going to be ready to be released back in the wild. But what they're going to do just before they release them in the islands, the baby tortoises, is to inject a microchip on their hind legs. In this way, they're going to keep a track on their activity on the islands, okay? The chip is going to be there for a long time
and they have those devices like the GPS, and they go back to the islands from time to time to check it out. We know that they are doing very well since this repatriation program started back in the middle 1960s. They have repatriated up to 4,800 or so tortoises, nearly 5,000 baby tortoises, actually. The most of them have been sent back to Española Island. On Española Island, nearly 2,000 tortoises have been repatriated. And the problem is still going on because the status, you know, of these animals is endangered. It's an endangered species. So we need to recover the number of tortoises because they were suddenly abundant back in time. You know, when the islands were just discovered by Spaniards, there were probably over 300,000 of them on the islands. But due to the activities of those sailors, such as pirates, whalers, and the like, actually more than 90% of them were taken away. The census they made back in the 1960s showed that only 15,000 tortoises remain in the whole archipelago. But nowadays they are over 20 or 25,000, considering the repatriated ones and considering they have been also breeding, you know, back in the wild, and they are nowadays protected because, well, the islands, you know, became a national park.
William Cox, naturalist, talking about some of the marvellous research being done on conserving the tortoises, which, of course, are fairly leisurely about their reproduction rate. They're not rushing to have sex.
Okay, from this place you get to see the little bin down there. So I'm going to tell you how the tortoises actually breed. You know, the male is usually bigger at least twice bigger than the female. So he's going to chase a female, say so, you know, in the breeding season, which is starting right now. Whenever he's closer to her, he's going to push her against the wall, against a tree or whatever, and then he mounts her from behind. The male has a concave shape underneath, you know, to fit on the upper shell of the female, and also a long tail where his penis is located, I mean underneath the tail. In this way they make contact, sexual contact. And afterwards, the female is going to lay the eggs some 3 or more weeks later. But they would be able to keep inside their shell the sperm there for a longer time, all right? So they will decide when to lay eggs. But whenever they lay eggs, what they do is to dig in the ground a small pit. The eggs are, by the way, like tennis ball, bigger than the sea turtle eggs, which are rather like ping pong balls, okay? Once she's done, she's going to cover the nest with the dirt. And then she urinates on top, and then she leaps. What do you think she urinates on top? No. It's right because later on it's going to make a thick paste, you know, with the dirt in order to protect the eggs. All right? Otherwise, she's not going to see the eggs again. She's not going to see the hatchlings either because, as I said before, they are independent from the very moment they emerge out of the nesting area. Then it's going to take about 120 to 150 days before the baby tortoises emerge from the nest. Once they break the eggshell underground, the baby tortoises do not come out immediately. They rather spend sometimes underground, and meanwhile they feed on the yolk that remains attached to their plastron, which is very nutritious, right? And it takes usually at least a couple of weeks, this process, okay? And only after that they come up to the surface. So in order to simulate what happens in the wild, they do about the same here. After they hatch from the incubators, they bring them to the dark boxes where they spend a couple of weeks or so, and then they go to the pens you have seen back there, all right? Now, they got two incubators there. What for? According to the scientific research, the sex of an embryo, it's determined by the temperature in the nest. So the parents' chromosomes have nothing to do with it, all right? So we know that at higher temperatures, we have females, and at lower temperature, we have males.
Typically.
That's why we have two incubators there, all right? And what we are trying to get more. Males or females?
Females.
Obviously females, more females. Actually, 75% of the eggs will go to the incubator with a higher temperature to get more females. In this way, there's going to be more chance to perpetuate a given species. So this is how it's working.
William Cox, who's a naturalist attached to the Darwin Centre, he tells me that Galapagos actually means saddleback, which describes one form of the tortoise's shell, one that is kind of arched in the front to enable the tortoise to reach up, as you may have seen in David Attenborough's marvellous three-part series. So the tortoise can reach up and gobble the flowers of the cactus, which is otherwise too high if you've got a normal shell. A normal shell, of course, allows you to barge through the undergrowth, like most of the Galapagos tortoises do. They release them after breeding them here at about the age of 4 or 5, when the shell has hardened, and that way they're not in any way vulnerable still to the predators such as the Galapagos hawk, which can otherwise zoom down and gobble up the youngster. And now we're reaching a very special enclosure.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this is a place where Lonesome George was living for the last 20 years. He was found on Pinda Island back in the early 1970s, actually in December 1971. It became suddenly a news worldwide because they thought the tortoises had been gone from that island a long time ago. So there was the last representative of a Pinta tortoise species. And they named this tortoise appropriately Lonesome George, all right? In February 1972, they transported the tortoise from Pinta Island to Santa Cruz to take care of him here in these facilities. They wanted to find another one desperately, so they organized several expeditions to go back to Pinta Island, and they surveyed the island in order to look for a female to measure the perpetuation of the species. The idea was to bring the female and to release her here with him in the same corral to encourage them to reproduce, and descendants will be repatriated later on back to Pinta Island to repopulate the tortoise population on that island. Well, the thing is that Lonesome George was isolated from the rest of tortoises here in the station by the waterfront down there. Actually, the first 20 years he spent down there, okay? And later on, because of an advice of a herpetologist, they built up a new corral to provide him more space and to let the visitors see him, because he's became a celebrity worldwide. Since they did an advertisement offering $10,000 reward after they failed in finding a female tortoise on the island of Pinta. So even though the advertisement gave no result, and George was still a solitary, a lonesome one, all right? So he spent the next 20 years of his life down here in this corral. And in 1992, they added a couple of female tortoises down there. These tortoises were taken from another island because on Pinta they were gone, okay? They made a DNA research and established a couple of female tortoises from Wolf Volcano on Isabel Island were likely to match, all right? So they put them down there to see what happens. And guess what happened?
Nothing.
Exactly. Or apparently nothing.
Well, you'd forget after 20 years, wouldn't you?
Well, there's several hypotheses about his behavior. They say that probably he never interacted with a female tortoise in his island because he grew up alone. So probably he never met them, he never learned. Or probably he was too old. And some say other things as well.
Couldn't have been gay.
Yeah, that's what they say.
A gay giant tortoise? Who'd have thought? But as you look into the next enclosure, another story. There's Diego, aged 150, still performing, as his two female companions can confirm. More on that next week. My thanks to William Cox at the Darwin Research Centre and all the other naturalists on the Galapagos Islands. Production by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams. Good evening.